Thank you for listening to an audio recording from the Midwest Genealogy Center's Tell Me a Story program, an initiative dedicated to preserving America's history through the timeless practice of oral storytelling. To learn more about the Tell Me a Story program, including how you can add your own story to the collection, visit MidwestGenealogyCenter.org/tellmeastory. On behalf of the Midwest Genealogy Center and Mid-Continent Public Library, we hope you enjoy the following story.
My name is John Bruce. I'm with the Alexander Madison Chapter of Greater Kansas City. I am the current president of the chapter, which was existed in 1966.
I'm George Pettigrew. I am the second vice president.
I'm Donna Madison. I am the treasurer.
Super Thomas Gregory, first sergeant, historian.
The reason why I became a Buffalo soldier, I have two relatives, John Bell, my uncle who served with the 10th Cavalry in Denver, Colorado. And I have another cousin, Junior Randall, which resided in St. Joseph, Missouri, and also was a Buffalo soldier who served with the 10th Cavalry.
I'm related to Isaac Johnson, my great-grandfather, my maternal great-grandfather. He started out as in the 38th Infantry, which was stationed at Fort Leavenworth with the 10th Cavalry. And he re-enlisted years later in the 9th Cavalry.
I'm the daughter of James G. Madison. He was in the 10th Cavalry in 1942 to 1945. His brother was also in, he was in the infantry. I don't know exactly what part he was in. I know it's the infantry, and he was there from 1941 to 45.
My name is Thomas Gregory. Nick Gregory is my great uncle. He lived in Tennessee, and he was a slave in Tennessee. And when the Civil War broke out, he joined the service. And then after the Civil War was over with, he still had time to do in the military, so he came into the 9th Cavalry in Fort Stanton, New Mexico.
My name is John Bruce. I introduced myself earlier as the president of Alexander Madison Chapter. We're here just to give you a little brief history of the black men who served in on the Western frontier from the beginning of the Civil War to the ending of 1944. We're talking about the Buffalo Soldiers. Actually, the Buffalo Soldier was came through the Civil War. At the end of the Civil War in 1865, they had abundance of black men who served in the Civil War. There was 33,000 gave their life for the Union Blue. At the end of the Civil War, Congress still had soldiers left over. So on July 28, 1866, provisions were made to put six regiments, black soldiers together, 38th, 39th, 40th, 41st, and the 9th and 10th Cavalry. As you know, the 9th Cavalry came out of Greenville, Louisiana. The 10th Cavalry came out of Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. 1866, the 10th Cavalry was organized in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, under the direction of Benjamin Grierson, old Civil War brevet general. The 10th Cavalry ended up with eight companies that was formed at Fort Leavenworth. Even though they had a trying time at Fort Leavenworth, the commander at Fort Leavenworth, which is Hoffman, did not like the black troops. He put them 1,000 yards down by the river, which was swampy area. They contacted malaria and a host of other diseases. So Grierson wrote the War Department and wanted to move these black troops. So he got permission to move these black troops in 1867 to Fort Riley, Kansas. There, from Fort Riley, Kansas, F Troop was sent out to Fort Hays. Once they was at Fort Riley, Fort Hays, where they engaged a bunch of Cheyenne warriors on the western frontier, F Troop. Lindsay was the first one to originally be called a Buffalo Soldier, which was in 1870. The name actually was Wild Buffalo before this term came in. They were responsible for telegraph lines, building forts, stagecoach lines, protecting settlers from the West.
Go on. They were the law and the order, which at that time they were garrisoned in small communities and an outpost where settlers were, in order to provide the only protection that was available from renegades, from Mexican marauders, from outlaws, rustlers, murderers, the worst of the West, where there was no law. The only law that stood between the citizens and the outlaws was the Buffalo Soldiers. They did perform the task that John had mentioned. They were escorting wagon trains on all of the trails. They were actually from the Missouri Division, and the Missouri Division had all of the Great Plains from northern New Mexico, from New Mexico all the way north to the border, and as far west as the Rocky Mountains. Fort Hays was one of the outposts that they used, and one of my favorite stories that comes out of that area was about 35 miles west on September 15th, and it was 1867, I believe, that while they were guarding one of the railroad camps, which they had to do, and they were looking to hunt for provisions. Well, two of the civilians from the camp and one trooper, went out on this hunt and didn't get very far before 70 Comanche were on them. They fought as much as they could. The two civilians were killed almost instantly, and the one Buffalo Soldier was wounded, but continued to fight. Well, he scrambled his way to a washout or underneath a railroad line and crawl up in there as far as he could for protection. His name was John Randall, by the way, and he was a private, but he was a very heroic private. Well, he fought as hard as he could because it was life or death. There was no one there to help him. His two companions were already dead at the time that he had been wounded, and now he's trapped by all of the Comanche. He is underneath this bridge, and he's fighting back as much as he can. But at the same time, they were trying to drive him out of his hiding spot by making the washout collapse in on him if they could, and they were spearing him with lances. He took 11 blows from lances and one bullet wound and continued to fight. Well, the story has been retold that the Indians kind of tired of it because they could not get him. They could not bring him down. They could not kill him. And they continued until that toy was over. So they turned, and as they left, here comes two civilians driving oxen toward the camp. And they were going to turn and go kill them instead. Well, by this time, support had come from the encampment, which was under the leadership of Sergeant Ed Davis and his G Troop. There were 8 other members, because there were only 9 of them all together on that assignment. Well, as they came, the Indians turned away from the two men with the oxen, therefore saving their lives. And when it was over, it was reported early on that John Randall only had 17 rounds for his pistol. He expended his 17 rounds, and they found 13 bodies of the renegades that were trying to run him down, the Comanche. So from this is one of those stories that demonstrates how 70 Comanches couldn't bring down one man. And of course, this tale spread. And what may have been the nucleus of the idea that the black or Buffalo Soldier was someone that was very hard to kill, a tenacious fighter, and reminded the Indian of the buffalo once wounded was more dangerous than at any other time. And the buffalo soldier seemed to fit, even though they weren't known by that name at that time. But this is one of those instances that seems to be the genesis of the reputation that they earned among their adversaries, the Indians. They got that same reputation among the Mexicans of the day, among the Spanish, anybody that was there that they ever had to engage, outlaws included. They didn't want any part of them. These guys were fierce, tenacious fighters. They would not give up. They had the courage and the ability to fight like they'd never seen before. And let's mention that many of the Indians of the day had never seen a black man in a blue uniform. So this was all brand new to them. Now there's someone else that was quite important in the day.
Thank you, there, Mr. President. Also, as you know, the Indian Wars for the 9th Cavalry ended in 1890. For the 10th Cavalry, it ended in 1886. They had idle time until 1898 when they went to the Spanish-American War in Cuba. Once over in Cuba, they were over for 1 year. When the 24th and 9th Cavalry returned to the United States, they were sent to California. There they became your first park rangers in 1899. They relieved all the white cavalry, been there since 1891. What's so unique about this is the hat that they brought back from Cuba. It was a Stetson that was reshaped, redesigned to tread water of the heavy rains in Cuba. To this day, it's called the Smokey the Bear hat. So the 9th Cavalry, the 24th Infantry, was your first one to be officially wear the Smokey the Bear hat. In 1916, the Buffalo Soldiers was the first one to be called your first Park Rangers. The first park superintendent was Captain Charles Young. That's just a little more history about the Buffalo Soldiers. Like I said, they served from 1866 to 1944. In 1948, Harry S. Truman, the president at that time, signed Executive Order 8891 to integrate all military service. It didn't go into effect in 1952.
During the time of the Civil War, there were slaves, of course, in the state of Missouri, as well as Arkansas and other states. And during this time, there was a family, a white family called the Johnsons, that lived somewhere in the vicinity of Independence, Missouri. And on that farm was a mother, a black a slave. Her name was Martha Williams, which they had taken the name of the family they were, that was their master. She had a daughter at that time, she was born around 1842. Her name was Kathy. The thing that's interesting about Kathy is that during the time of the Civil War, in Missouri, there was an order, number 11, that was issued by General Ewing to try and get control of get rid of the Southern sympathizers. So this order was to get rid of all of the Southern sympathizers in the counties, Jackson, Clay, Cass, Bates, and Vernon. They were given 10 days to leave that area. So most of the people who had slaves during that time, they left and went to Texas and Arkansas. Kathy was one of these was part of one of these groups that left. From what we read, she ended up in Jefferson City. And during that time, the Union Army came through and took a lot of slaves off the farms as contraband. She was one of them, and they taught her how to cook and do the washing for the soldiers that were caught up in this war. She went several places with the Union soldiers during that time. She ended up at one time during at the Battle of Pea Ridge. She was a laundress and a cook, and she did a little bit of first aid. And when that time was over, the Civil War ended, she ended up back in St. Louis. And she was told, you know, you're a free person, you go where you want to go. Well, this is a young girl. She, at that time, she was, well, young lady. She was around 22, 23 or 24, not sure exactly. And at that time, United States had given the order to have six units, which Trooper Bruce had told you about, that were able to enlist in the peacetime army. When she was told about that, she didn't just jump in, because I think it was like around November when she actually joined, and she joined because there was a friend and a cousin that talked to her about this, and she was in a situation of, what am I going to do? And I imagine with her and a lot of other women, it's like a survival instinct. If I can do something, whatever I need to do to survive, I'll do it. So she ended up joining. And you're probably wondering, well, how could she do that? How is a woman going to do that? This lady was 5 feet 9 inches tall. She was 126 pounds. And they said she looked exactly like a man. So that means she was probably not very busty. So it would have been pretty easy for her to get in. She changed her name from Kathy Williams to William Kathy, which was easy for her to remember. Somebody said, William, come here. Well, she'd know that was her name. She had no trouble getting in because during that time they didn't do physicals. So there was no reason for them to be concerned about whether this was male or female. She looked like a man. So looked like a man. looked like a duck. Talk like a duck, whatever, must be a duck. Anyway, she served for 22 months, and it was a drooling thing for her, I'm pretty sure. I'm just imagining, I don't know for sure, but I do have the muster records. And her muster records always shown that she was very neat and very obedient. She did everything she needed to do to stay out of the limelight, not to be noticed, and that gave her the ability to stay with them for 22 months. During this time, there were other things going on, such as your Black Seminole Indian Scouts, and we're going to let Mr. Gregory tell you.
Well, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Gregory family. my name is First Sergeant, in fact, it's Trooper First Sergeant Thomas Gregory. My family goes back to the Civil War. Had two uncles, Ned and Thomas. And what happened, the Gregory family was slaves in Kentucky. And they sold one of my uncles, was Ned, to a family in Tennessee. Well, Jefferson Davis came down during the Civil War and asked the Tennesseans how many of the blacks would fight for the South. Well, my uncle was one of the 240 of them that raised his hand and said, I will. If you go in your history books and type in Ned or Net Gregory, Tennessee First Regiment, that's my great uncle. Thomas joined the Northern Army. So when the Civil War was over with, they still had time in the service. So Ned became a buffalo, he became a horse soldier, because buffalo soldier invented that before that. He served in Fort Stanton, New Mexico for 2 years. Then after that, he went to Fort Robinson. But the buffalo soldiers and the Seminole Indians and everything, you know, you have to go back to the beginning. We always start Buffalo Soldiers, 9th and 10th Cavalry, Buffalo Soldiers, 19th, but we forget about the black Seminole Indians. There's a Seminole Indian and a black Seminole Indian. It's different. The reason why the one's called black Seminole Indian is because he has Seminole Indian blood in him. The blacks in the slaves in the Florida escaped from the plantations and integrated into the Seminole Indian race in California, in Florida. Then what happened, they shift those fellows up to the southern part of the United States. That'd be like, actually southwest of the United States. And then by 1870, the U.S. government said we needed scouts. Well, they already had Apache scouts, but the Native Americans, they kind of banded together. The Anglo-Saxon did not really trust the Apaches. So that's what they said, what we got to do is get some scouts. So they got 20 of the black Seminoles. And these 20 black Seminoles guarded the border from New Mexico, Texas, Arizona, that whole area down through there. And the it's about, if I get my figures right, I think it's about 18, but not over 20 of them. But they served from 1870 to 1890. And John Horse had a grandson. Well, Chief John Horse of the Black Seminoles never became a Buffalo Soldier, but his grandson did, like it. And then after the Civil War, after the Indian Wars were over with, the U.S. government promised the Native Americans, the Seminoles, so much land, it never was honored. Thank you was a slap in the face. What they did, bring your weapons in, bring your horses in, and we're going to put you on a train and send you to Florida for a reservation. They never did honor the black Seminole Indians. But my family goes back to the Civil War, the Indian War, and also Spanish-American War. Sergeant Bruce.
We also have some famous marshals that served with the 10th Cavalry or the 9th, respectively. Willie Kennard, who was a U.S. Marshal for over 30 years, who served the 9th. Also, there was another famous marshal by the name of Bass Reeves.
Bass Reeves was born arguably between Paris, Texas, or West Arkansas. Not sure, but he was born a slave. He was a tall gentleman, stood well over 6 feet, very thin. Could not read, could not write. In his 30 years of service, he had over 3,000 arrests. And the way he was able to always serve the right warrant on the right criminal was that he would remember how the signature looked. Couldn't read it, but remembered exactly how it was shaped, what the look was. Therefore, he remembered the name and could pull through any of his warrants to find the person. Never arrested the wrong person, never missed an arrest, never was wounded, and was the most successful U.S. Marshal under the hanging Judge Parker out of Fort Smith, Arkansas. The one amazing thing that history overlooks is that the paths of so many well-known heroes and figures of American history cross path with the Buffalo Soldiers.
Also, during that time, Bass Reeves also, the movie, the film, the TV film, Long Ranger, was based off of Bass Reeves. Bass Reeves rode a white horse and had an Indian scout. At one time, he arrested his own son.
Getting back to Kathy Williams, while she was in the service, she was in the 38th Infantry, meaning that she was a walker, a marcher. And before she was able to begin her career as a soldier, she got sick, and she was left in St. Louis at Jefferson Barracks Hospital for 30 days. There were two other soldiers with her, and when she finally was able to join up with her company, which was Company A, she joined them in Fort Riley, Kansas. And she was there for a short time. That's where she got most of her basic training with the other two soldiers. They went together. And then they started their trek out west, which was marching. Kathy, as a soldier, had to use the everything that the men did, meaning the packs, the backpacks, the rifles, all the things that the men carried, she had to do. And she did that without complaint. There was nothing in her record that she complained or even pretended to be ill for any reason to try and get out of doing her job. There was something that happened, an altercation that happened during the time she was at Fort Riley. The soldiers she was with got in trouble. Some of them went into, they were jailed. And she made it very clear after she was discharged from the service that she never got in trouble, that she had never had a bayonet at her back. She was a good soldier, and she kept her nose clean. And I can understand why she would do that. You're not going to do anything to draw attention to yourself when you're an alias. When they found out that she was a female, this was during the time of her, she was in New Mexico at Fort Baird. And during that time, or even before that time, she had some illnesses that kind of kept her off from doing her duties. And, of course, anytime you weren't doing your job, your pay was cut. And I imagine that's kind of hard for a soldier. But, of course, you're being fed, and you get clothing, and you're getting, place to sleep. I don't know what she was doing with her money. I don't know if maybe she could have been sending her pay to her mom. I don't know. But when you're not getting much in the first place, it's kind of hard when your pay is cut because you're ill and not doing your job. So I imagine that was hard for her also. But when she was so sick that she couldn't do her job, and this went on more than a week or 2 or 3 weeks, I mean, when it went into a month or more, then it's time to take notice as far as the commanders are concerned. And this is what happened to her. Her commanding officer insisted that she go to the company surgeon. That's what they had to say, infirmary during that time. So she went to the company surgeon, and I imagine, you know, she had to be pretty ill at that time to even go to give it up. Say, okay, it's time for me to give it up. And when she was discovered as a female, she stated that the word got around, and all of the her colleagues at that time that were friendly, and they were angry that a woman had tricked them, and they were so angry that they insisted that the Army put her out right now. I mean, exactly now. And I'm sure that hurt her, you know, to no ends. The people that you thought were your friends and supported you, they don't want you around. So she, when she was not discharged right at that time. She stayed, of course she was not allowed to continue, but she stayed with her commanding officer for a while and did what she learned to do in the beginning, that was to cook and clean house, and they called them domestic servants. That's what she did. She stayed on the fort for a while, and then eventually she moved on. Baird, New Mexico was in the southern part of New Mexico. She eventually moved north. And as she went north, she did what she knew to do to get by. During the time of her, her discharge, when she was finally discharged, was at Los Animas County, Trinidad, Colorado. That's where she was living during that time. In 1868, she got her official discharge around April of that year. From that time on, she did what she knew to do. She worked as a domestic servant. She also worked in a factory. Well, it wasn't really a factory. It was a laundry service. It was on Commercial Street in Trinidad, Colorado. She was well known during that time, and during that time, her mother had moved to Pueblo, Colorado, which Kathy spent a little time in Pueblo, and I assume it was with her mom at a nursery. That was during about 1880s.
Also, we want to tell you about a famous gentleman, Jackie Robinson. A lot of you know Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in 1947, who played the Brooklyn Dodgers. He also was a second lieutenant in the 10th Cavalry. At one point in time, they once tried to court-martial him because he would not give up his seat on a bus. So that's just basically about a lot of the famous people who served with the 9th and 10th Cavalry. Also, if you go back in the time, like I spoke about the 9th, the 10th, the 38th, and 39th, 40th, 41st, they combined the four infantry divisions to the 24th and 25th in 1869. They still exist today. The 24th and 25th served in Vietnam. The 10th Cavalry, which is out of Fort Hood, Texas, is mechanized. They're the 10th Cavalry Division now. They also served in Vietnam as well as Korean War. So this is just that some of the numbers that went away are still here today with modern time, even though everything mechanized, but at one time I will say the 9th, the 10th, the 24th, 25th, at one point in time in World War II, did not fight as a regiment. They were still facing the color barrier, even though most of them The Tuskegee Airmen came from the Buffalo Soldiers. A lot of you don't know at the enlistment. The all black tankers. You had the 555th with all black paratroopers that was existing in 1943. So that's just a little of a history about the Buffalo Soldier and Tuskegee Airmen. There's so much history out there. It would take you almost 2-3 weeks to tell you exactly everything they had accomplished, even though they had 24 Congressional Medal winner honors.
You know, there were other famous people that passed that way. For example, George Armstrong Custer. There's no one that knows the West that doesn't know General Custer. Well, General Custer was one officer that was well thought of, a little flamboyant, but turned down the opportunity to lead the Buffalo Soldiers 9th Cavalry. They were beneath him. He would not do it. Now, it is said how lucky the 9th is, because we all know what happened to Custer before it was all over. He wasn't the only one that passed that way. You heard earlier about Willie Kennard, and then there were also many, many people that Jackie Robinson was one. But also, the Buffalo Soldiers were the ones that were most effective, and or as effective as anyone had ever been, fighting some of the greatest Native American chiefs and medicine men that are known in history today. Victorio, Nana,
Geronimo,
even during the Boom Invasion, but he and Frederick Remington, believe it or not, the famous artist. Frederick Remington also was serving with the black troops, the Buffalo Soldiers. General Black Jack Pershing got his nickname because as soon as he was assigned out of the academy as a second lieutenant, it was a matter of choice because there were plenty of officers, white officers, that would not serve with black troops, just didn't think it was right, didn't want it to happen. Well, Pershing wasn't one of those people. He was one that did. And as soon as his assignment came out to join the Buffalo Soldiers as a second lieutenant, he was scorned. And they started off by calling him Nigger Jack Pershing, which was softened to Black Jack, which we all know, Black Jack Pershing. Very, very famous general. As a matter of fact, maybe the most famous general out of World War I. Surprisingly, too, Abner Doubleday, the founder of baseball, served with the Buffalo Soldiers. These are things that we never hear about. Now, there were over 100 white officers that served with the black troops on the frontier. And there were more generals to come out of service with the black troops than any other regiment in the history of the military, the United States military. Let's step back a bit, because to let you know where the soldiers were, they came from nowhere. They came from nothing. They had nothing. They'd never been allowed to. You could find yourself dead even if you were too successful in business. So it was a very dangerous time. And there were plenty of people that were against blacks serving in uniform. Now, we have served in every war America's ever been in, from the very beginning. And it's well known now that the very first person to die in Boston in the Revolutionary War was a black man. So we have given our lives and our blood, we've given our service to this country through every encounter this country's ever been engaged in. The problem was the country never returned the gratitude. The gratitude that the soldiers that continued to fight, continued to enlist, continued to serve, expected that they could prove themselves worthy of citizenship, full citizenship. But the government and the people were against it. Here's where things changed. In 1866, when the reorganization was passed and the 6 regiments of black troops were brought under the peacetime army for the first time in military history in the United States. It was really a utopia. because here people that were property previously, and some were free men, but most were coming out of servitude, slavery, as property. Never had a gun, never possessed anything, couldn't even possess themselves or their children. No education, it was forbidden. Well, that changed, because once 1865 happened, the war is over, people are free, there was really no opportunity for them. Nowhere to go in peace, not north or south. The army offered them something that had never been done before, and I'm not sure it's been done quite that way since. The army structure was that a chaplain would be assigned to a post. For example, there was a chaplain at Fort Leavenworth. But with the colored troops, as they were first called, they assigned a chaplain to each regiment. This chaplain would move with that body instead of being fixed at a post, as had been custom always. And the chaplains had one order, that was to educate the troops, teach them reading, writing, and basic arithmetic, an opportunity they never been provided. Now, imagine coming from slavery. And let me use my great-grandfather, Isaac Johnson, as an example. He comes out of Montgomery, Alabama. He didn't know where he was early on in his life as a little boy. He only had one person that he considered family, that was his sister. He knew nothing about where his mother or father was, or who they were. It's never told. All he knew is that his name was Isaac, and he had a sister named Mary. Well, the first time he ever left that plantation, he was put on a wagon with his sister, and they went riding along. He never seen anything off that plantation in his young life. Didn't know where he was, didn't know where he was going. Now, it was important not to tell slaves exactly where they were or exactly which way to go, because you don't want to encourage or in any way support runaways. So he had no idea where he was. He ended up at a slave market, and he witnessed his sister being sold. He was still too young to understand what was happening. Remember, this is his first time he ever left the plantation. What he did realize was on the return home on that wagon, his sister was no longer there. Now, we can only assume that he did not sail, and that's why he returned to the plantation. But from a beginning like that, where there is no education, and now he's all alone, we can only assume that, as they say, it takes a village to raise a child. Well, in the quarter, in the slave quarters, that village had to take responsibility for that little boy who was now all alone. No idea where his sister went. Saw her on the slave block for the last time on the auction block. Never saw her or heard of her again. Well, the daughter of the master of the plantation gave Isaac to his daughter as a wedding gift. And she moved to Montgomery, Alabama. Now, there are gaps in the story at that time, because we know that Mary was in the hotel business, and that Isaac worked there for her. Some say as a clerk. But, of course, in Montgomery, Alabama, you had to keep your head low and mind your business and don't show anything more that would put you in danger. It was a dangerous time. So coming from a beginning like that, where he never held or owned a gun, where he didn't know how to read or write, he ended up joining. Signing up, and when the black troops were authorized in 1866, he joined in 1867. And first location he found himself was Jefferson Barracks, which is now in St. Louis, Missouri, south side of St. Louis, Missouri, near the river. From there, he was transferred and joined up with the 38th Infantry, which is the same unit that Kathy Williams was in. Now, we're wondering whether or not these two knew each other, and I sure hope Isaac Johnson, my great-grandfather, wasn't on that hateful side that turned against Kathy. I hope he was one of the ones that understood what his sister had meant to him and how valuable he praised and cared about her. So I hope he had that same attitude toward Kathy. And what is funny is that there were four infantry groups at that time, as John has said, the 38th, 39th, 40th, and 41st. Well, early on, he joined up and was assigned to the 38th. From Jefferson Barracks, the 38th out of those four infantry units, three of the infantry units, 39th, 40th, and 41st, were sent south to Louisiana. Only one infantry unit, the 38th, was assigned to the same place that the 10th Cavalry was, and that was the Missouri Division at Fort Leavenworth. From there, we know that Isaac was given one of the routine assignments of an infantryman, and that was guarding the mail. So here he is riding the coach, guarding the mail. He's in Rice County, Kansas, which is east of Dodge City. He's crossing Cow Creek. And there's some wonderful stories about that area. One is that there was a young white man that was attempting to establish a post at Cow Creek Crossing, which was on the Santa Fe Trail. He went by the young white man that dug a well by hand, was called Buffalo Billy. Now, we're not saying that's the Buffalo Bill that everyone knows, but the story does go that when you're young and you're going to be an adventurer like that, then if you're young, you're still Billy. And everybody might have been referred to as Buffalo because that was the wildest side or that part of the trade. And trust me, you were fighting for your life. Well, Isaac is riding with the mail, crossing Cow Creek. There's a little post there, but no sooner they cross it, he takes a bullet in his shoulder. What's strange is that the mail did not stop. They cared for him on the move, took the bullet out, wrapped him up, and he had to stay on his post guarding that mail. There's no way back. They weren't going to leave him. He had a job to do. He had to do it. He rode from central Kansas, east of Dodge City, to northern New Mexico at Fort Union, which had a large hospital, the same hospital that Kathy Williams was discovered at, or outed, we should say. At that location was where he received proper care for that wound. Now imagine, even in a car, riding with a bullet wound from central Kansas to northern New Mexico. Back then, that trip took weeks. So these people, and Kathy was bigger than Isaac. Isaac was about 140 pounds, pretty much the same weight, but he was only 5'7". So Kathy Williams was a bigger man than he was. And both serving in the 38th, both stationed at Fort Union, New Mexico, north East New Mexico on the Santa Fe Trail, which was really the terminus for the military on the Santa Fe Trail. And it's about 60 miles outside of Santa Fe itself. So all of these things cross paths. All these people knew each other. And I would like to think that Isaac knew Kathy and respected for the fact that she was a great soldier. But let's put this all in context too. I found amazing that even though if you watch the movies, the TV, you get the impression that those that were guarding and making the West available to settlers, to trade, were all Anglo-Saxons. That's the portrayal. There are a few stories out there that say no. Some of the brunettes, as they were called, were also there. And those brunettes were later called Buffalo Soldiers. They were also called much nastier things by their fellow soldiers. I know that Isaac Johnson, in guarding the move west, the frontier, was not allowed inside the camp, the very camps that he was traveling with, the very wagon trains that were out there would not allow the black soldiers in. they had to set up their own little separate.
It's camp. Also written where Kathy Williams was also at Fort Larned during the time that Custer was there. They also, as you said, they did camp outside of the fort. They weren't allowed inside the fort. And she marched from Fort Larned to Fort Hawker, Fort Hayes, and all of these forts that were along the Santa Fe Trail, as you were saying. And it's a possibility because that was during 1867, mm-hmm. during that time.
Same year.
That's the same time that Isaac was, you know, with that unit. So they probably did know each other.
I knew, especially
and
if she was out.
Only knew each other as William Cathy.
Right. And a good soldier.
Yes, yes. And she did spend quite a bit of time at Fort Union. Because she went to Fort Union before she went to Fort Baird. Mm. Another thing that happened with her, once she was out, Kathy, a lot of times I don't tell this story when I'm portraying her, she got married. Kathy did get married. There's no record of when she got married, but during the census, I think it was the 1880s, during that time it did show that she was married. She makes reference to her marriage that he was no count man. He stole her money, which was $100, a wagon, and a mule. Now, you know, Kathy knew how to shoot a gun. And she could have probably, if she had been one of those, they call them hell-bent women, she probably blown him up, you know. But she didn't do that. She went to the sheriff and had him arrested. And there was no mention of whether she got a divorce or what. But she put him where he needed to be. And she moved on with her life. Got to the point where she was pretty in bad shape. I mean, considering we don't know what was going on with her during the time she was discharged, but her commanding officer said she was feeble and unfit for duty. And nobody knows what was going on exactly. There was a lot of things said in her medical record that supposedly was going on with her, but there was nothing specific except that when she had her, she did file for a pension, and that's why we know about her. She filed for a pension in 1891 because by that time she was in such dire straits that I think she decided, okay, I never wanted to live off of friends and family and all that, but it got just so bad. Well, maybe I can get some pension or something from the government. When she filed, they did an examination. This time, yes, she's a female. They wanted her to prove that she and William Cathy was the same, which they knew. The government already knew. And they found at that time that she had high blood pressure. At that, she had shrunk 2 inches. She was 5 feet 7 inches tall. She weighed about 149 pounds. And she also was missing all toes on both feet except for one on each foot. We don't know. There's been speculation that she was had diabetes. We don't know that. We know that she marched from Fort Riley all the way to Fort Union and never had a problem. But, you know, during the time that she was marching, you had snow And I'm sure, you know, we know what snow is like in Kansas now. Can you imagine what it was like in 1800s? Camping out in tents and stuff like that, anything could have happened. One of her muster records show that one time when they had inspection, her clothing was in good shape, but her shoes were really bad. So it could have been frostbite or whatever to cause her toes to be amputated. It says there's no record of when she died. They say she died in 1892, but I say that she probably died between 1892 and 1900, because there's nothing to show that she died in 1892. One other person that we want to mention is Flipper, Henry O. Flipper. He was the first black cadet to graduate from West Point. He was very instrumental in helping Grierson during the time he was chasing some of these desperados out in the West.
I want to finish by telling two things that I hope will identify just how unique a group of people they were, the Buffalo Soldiers. Understand that even though the portrayal doesn't show that these soldiers were as vital as they were to the West, they were the best fighting soldiers, the most prepared soldiers going into the Spanish-American War in Cuba, bar none. And that includes the Rough Riders and their leader,
Teddy Roosevelt.
But let me say this. In the West, there were 40% of the Union forces were black soldiers. 40%. Yet, they performed 60% of all of the engagements in the frontier West. And one other thing was that, as we mentioned, that the chaplain's job was to train or to teach. No soldier ever failed to pass his courses as he learned to read, write, and do basic math. Not one. No soldier missed class unless his assignment took him away from his teachings. These guys dug in and gave their best. They fought best, they learned best, and they changed it. Now, let's wrap this up.
Let me say one more. Yes. In closing, during the post-Civil War, they had a great enlistment from all walks of life. These guys were free slaves, farmers, tobacco growers, cigar makers, regardless. And their pay was $13 a month. To them, that was a pay for them. They never had, even though sometimes they did not get the pay 6-7 months later, but that was something they honored. They never got paid for being a slave, so that was part of it.
A lot of people don't realize, you got to go back to the beginning. We got to go back to the beginning. The Buffalo Soldiers, they said, where do these guys come from? They come from Africa. When the Europeans went into Africa to get the slaves, they saw a race of people was strong, healthy, and were intelligent in their own surroundings and everything. The Anglo-Saxons said, if we take this black man back to the States, gonna incarcerate him, make him do this and do that, he would not do it. Because they had a way of life that was different from the Europeans and everything. They saw this here. So the only way we're gonna conquer this black man is to separate him. Take his family, put him over here, take his kids, put him here. Don't tell me you're not going to do this. During the Civil War, there was more blacks in the battlefield than both armies. The United States had 185,000 black men fighting for the North. They had 80,000 fighting for the South. Put them all together, they almost had 300,000 men. It was more. But yet, they asked these black men, pick up your arms, come and fight for us, what the South did and the North did and everything. But yet, they never gave them equal rights. until they passed the proclamation of Lexington. But these soldiers, when they went into battle, they had to prove themselves, not to nobody else. When these fellows was out there working, polishing their buttons and everything, when the Anglo-Saxons were relaxing and everything, they would polish their buttons with urine and sand and everything. These were strong men, but they come from a strong nation of people. Sir, go ahead.
Yeah. This is entitled Fiddler's Green. It comes from the 9th and 10th Horse Cavalry Association, which is the official Army unit association. Fiddler's Green. When a cavalryman dies, he begins a long march to his ultimate destination. About halfway along the road, he enters a broad meadow dotted with trees and crossed by many streams known as Fiddler's Green. As he crosses the green, he finds an old canteen, a single spur, and a carbine sling. Traveling along, he comes upon a field camp where he finds all troopers who have gone before him with their campfires, tents, and picket lines neatly laid out. All other branches of service must continue to march without pause. The cavalrymen, though, are authorized to dismount, unsaddle, and stay in the Fiddler's Green. Their canteens ever full, the grass always green, and enjoy the companionship and reminiscence of old friends. This is a tribute to our deceased troopers.